Hello, everyone. It's nice to see you, as those of you that I can see on my small screen. But it's very nice to see everyone. This is a beginning here. This is a happy new year, right? This is the first day of the beginning of a new time frame as decided by human beings. This idea of a time frame is as old as humanity starting to certainly plant crops. And I would guess all the way back to even when we were hunters and gatherers, because the time of year and the light changes makes such a difference in the way human beings could survive out on the savannah. And so we are wired in, at least from the time that human beings have been manifesting, and maybe we're wired in a more mysterious way to notice change and to have ceremony, some instinctive need for ceremony around time change. That, again, as far as we can tell, as old as humanity. And the Machu Picchu, for instance, the measuring of the stars and all of this was also, they hypothesized the time of the year. I've stood in that room and also there, the Valley of the Moon and all, and looked at that and watched, tried to imagine what that was like. And so we are gathering here this evening, not just as a time of being with the Dhamma, which every moment is a good time for being with the Dhamma, but also as occasioned by this changing of the time that we're engaging in. And the cliche version of this, we take our New Year's resolutions, right? If we were really going to do this, it would be more tied to the change of light, the solstice change. But this is the time that it has worked out. So we can make any time a ritual time if the community is agreeing to it. And so this is a time that we are here in that context. And I'm saying all this on the front end before we start the meditation, because the talk tonight is a very heartfelt speaking to you about your practice and about empowering your life, about the Dhamma and how you're relating to the Dhamma empowering your life in your daily life, and all of the decisions you make and all of the relationships you have and your ongoing internal relationship with yourself. So it's hopefully I will smile at times, but it's really a kind of calling forth that I think is appropriate because you're interested in the Dhamma. And so this is appropriate in this way. So we'll start with our meditation, and then there will be a 10-minute break, something like that, and then we'll come back and look at this. And I'm going to give a lot of specific suggestions and references, so you might during the break want to have something to take notes on, if something that you go, I want to remember that you're ready for that. So here we go. And again, I hope that this period of time that's the end of a year has been a peaceful enough time for you and allowed some time for rest and renewal as we start this new year. And we start with, maybe this is our first formal meditation for many of us online of the new year. Arriving where? In this moment, arriving here and now, in this space, the space where you are participating in the meditation, those conditions, this here, the conditions that are here now. A feeling of that, that you feel yourself here in this space. And how do we do that? By bringing mindfulness front and center. Bringing mindfulness all the way around all of our senses. Permeating our senses with mindfulness. Having mindfulness accompany each sense experience, just as an intention, not like, oh, I got to be mindful here, got to be mindful here. It's not some sort of efforting, but it's more of an invitation, more of a commitment. Arriving here as things are now, in this moment. Externally and internally. Arriving here in this very moment, here now, mindfulness front and center. This arriving is something we often skip. We sit down to meditate and we somehow think we're supposed to just start meditating, but we don't gather and collect ourselves so often. We don't become into a space where meditation is naturally arising, but we can. And let's see if that's possible this evening. Arriving. You may notice that you start to feel the immediacy of the moment. Could be through any and all sense gates, just the mind itself. You are registering the moment, no matter what is causing the moment, what sense gate or the mind itself that's causing this, that's so much less important. Then you notice the immediacy of the moment is available to you. And in fact, you realize that there is a kind of being present as a felt sense, that you are mindfully present. You are here in this moment, in a fullness. You're mindful of your experience as it's arising. That being present has its own felt sense. So it's not that you're continuing to notice the mindfulness. You and the mindfulness are one. You are simply present. Present meaning that whatever is occurring in the moment, you're able to receive it. To know it. The moment is available to you. A because you're available to the moment. So powerful. When this has continuity, that present becomes presence, and we feel a continuity of simply being here, being available to this moment, in this moment. So empowering. Why is it empowering? Because we have choice when we're present. Before and after, we can't be present for. Only now, only here. But when we are, we have choice. Choice as to what? Choice as to how we're going to relate to this moment. We can choose to continue paying attention to it, or we can choose to think about something else or direct our attention somewhere else to one of the other senses. If there's something like a lot of pain, emotional or physical, sometimes we can't choose to take our minds away, but then we still have the choice to choose how we're relating. And this is where the Dhamma comes in, of course. The Dhamma teaches us, empowers us, gives us a map for relating to the moment in a way that allows us to choose non-suffering over suffering. Wow. And it starts with being available, available to the moment, and having the moment available to us. This is a felt sense experience, the felt sense of being present, being available, naturally arises as a felt sense. Notice if this is true for you in this moment. This feeling, this felt sense of being available is the beginning point of making change in your life. Throughout each day of my life, I repeatedly notice or ask, am I available in this moment to life? Am I available to the Dhamma in this moment? And on the phone, and walking, and sitting at my desk. What we discover, if you make this a practice of being available, we discover that just because we're available, doesn't mean that it'll be wholesome thoughts or images that arise. The Buddha taught that our mind can think anything, have any experience. We already know this from our own history. And thus, having arrived, become available, we realize also that we need to be aligned with something that protects us from all of the ways that our mind can get distracted, succumb to irritation, to complaining, to fear, to boredom. And so we choose, as our mindfulness practice, as part of our mindfulness practice, to align. To align with something that protects us from these tendencies of mind, and also something that inspires us, that creates an uplifting feeling, calls forth our better inspired self. This could be anything, but if, as far as the Buddhist practice, it's within the Buddhist traditions of teachings. If you're really just here as a drop-in and not really involved in the Buddhist practice, you might choose something from another religion or just your humanistic values. We align to the Buddha or align to the Dhamma. We align to the Sangha. These are the three refuges that have been taught for 2,600 years now. They are uplifting. Our own Buddha nature, the generosity of the Buddha's teachings, the generosity of all those that have kept it alive, the truth of the Dhamma, truth that we can know directly, experience for ourselves, truth that's naturally arising when we know how to be present for it to arise. So inspiring. Or maybe for you, it's the Eightfold Path. Or it's metta, loving kindness. Or it's compassion that you align with. So just kindness. Kindness under all conditions. This we call the Brahma Viharas, the heavenly abodes, for where the mind is resting in such wholesome places through practice. Your wish to not cause harm. At some point, again, there is this feeling of a felt sense of being aligned. You can feel it. It's felt sense. It's embodied felt sense, just like with available, just like the felt sense of arriving. In this kind of practice, the felt sense, so important. We get out of our heads and our comments that we do in our heads to simply being here now, available and aligned. Wow, are we ready to meet the moment? Do we have choice? We're not starting with some preconceived view of anything. So no, we're not putting a concept in between us and our experience. It's from our values directly into our hearts. My heart is available and aligned in this moment. It's an embodied feeling. And my mental capacity recognizes it. It is this set of conditions that allows change. It allows recognition of what's called for, realization that we can respond as best we're able, heart, body, mind available. And we discover that when we developed presence through mindfulness, that we have the resolve to say no when no is appropriate, to say yes, even though we feel timid, uncertain, when yes is what's appropriate. We learn to moderate the middle way, because we're present, available, and aligned. This initiatory practice, this first part of meditation, if we choose to do it when we sit in meditation, brings so much presence, so much power, so much agency to our practice. Can you feel that here and now? We haven't turned to all the objects that arise in the mind. Not yet. First, we are preparing. First, we're getting in touch. First, we are creating this connection to agency, to choice, to empowerment. Coming into ourselves. Always, it's as best I am able. This humility is so appropriate in our practice and in our living our daily lives and all the roles we play, all our life situations. May I do as best I am able. May I be available and aligned such that I have that choice to do as best I am able. I am present in a way that is empowering, that gives one an agency of choice. So wholesome. The heart can feel that wholesomeness. The mind can recognize it. Oh. Deep bows to the Venerable Anālya, who inspired me to do this practice in its fulfillment, its fullness, its feeling tone. If in the mornings you only did this for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, how different your day might be. The heart can be open even when it's uncertainty of our daily lives, if we are available and aligned in an embodied way. We're less likely to forget, to feel overcome, to feel desperate to go back to a behavior that is not supportive to our own well-being. We're not doing it in a fixing mode. We're being discriminating. We're discerning what's skillful and not skillful. So all of that judging and comparing is not necessary. Does this happen all at once? No. We build this capacity by practice. When we're sitting in meditation, and when we're walking down the street and talking with another, we're sitting by ourselves. You're always utilizing this method of practice, practicing the Dhamma, walking the path. It becomes a habit. One doesn't have to keep bringing oneself back so often. One can go right ahead with one's life, and this was the attitude, the environment, the inner environment from which you're meeting all of these different aspects. Having established ourselves for Vipassana practice in this manner, we turn to the experience of the physical body. The first of the Satipatthanas that the Buddha taught, these baskets, these fields of what arises as our experience, awareness of the body, the physicalness of life. So you turn just to know the body. May I experience the physical body? From this openness, this lack of agenda, you may have a slightly different or quite a bit different experience of body. The felt sense may be more important than whether it's the sensations of body that you're noticing. The form that the body's in. The Buddha taught mindfulness of the body in the body until one knows there is a body. And so we come to our own experience. It's really true. This awareness, this innate awareness, this many levels of consciousness is in this embodiment. There's not even a need for me and mine. It's just true. This knowing capacity is embodied in this fathom-long body. This one means of mindfulness can lead us to the first level of liberation it is taught. Just noticing. This feeling of embodiment in this way. It's really incredible that you are having, I am having, everyone together is having an experience that is here and now in this embodiment. And it's being known in a reflective way. So there's awakeness right here. It can be a little scary or unsettling to actually start to feel that for the first few times. But if not now, when? You notice the breath. You may be trained in noticing the breath. This is your anchor object, your go-to, to stay present. Are you making a mental note of the breath, or are you having a felt sense of it? Can you open your heart to feeling the aliveness that's there in the breath? How tender. The breath becomes quite fascinating when we're feeling the aliveness. This is the vital part of consciousness, the aspect dimension of consciousness that can recognize our own vitality. this aliveness in the breath, this vitality aspect of our consciousness. Gives us a perspective so that when difficult things come that are pleasant or unpleasant, the second foundation of mindfulness, there's some ground that we're receiving it from, such that in time, the unpleasant becomes just unpleasant. And we don't get so caught. It's still unpleasant, but we don't get so caught. And likewise, the pleasant, which we can also get caught in so easily, wanting more, justifying why we have it and someone else doesn't, getting caught in manipulating another person for our pleasantness. It loses that power over us. Pleasant becomes just pleasant. We have choice based on our values, based on how we're aligned. This too empowers change in our daily life. We are grounded in something larger than our conditioning. In your heart, you can feel this possibility, possibly here and now, this very moment, literally. We're awake to life rather than awake to the soap opera of our lives, which will continue, but we can have a more empowered relationship to that soap opera. We can hold the narrative of our lives in a different way, just as we are, not a new improved version of us. For 40 years, the Buddha taught this, walking barefoot on dusty paths, putting up with all sorts of annoyances himself, not being defined by the unpleasantness of the things that happened to him, not being caught by things that were pleasant at all. Because he was resting in the here and now from this liberated point of view. Each of us can do this slightly. Sometimes, as best we're able, we just don't remember it. We just don't have the frame sometimes to orient ourselves. And so our emotional lives, which we know through this aspect or dimension of consciousness, it's kind of an emotional body of consciousness. Having understood pleasant and unpleasant, having understood that being available to life has more intrinsic value than any passing emotion. We don't become indifferent to emotions. Who would want that? Who wouldn't want to be indifferent to the joy of a child, of feeling the tenderness of someone caring for us, or you caring for someone, taking care of them? Who would want to be indifferent? But how we do it, how we care, how we interact, how we're relating to this emotional and emotions and thoughts mixed together in this aspect of consciousness. We, in time, realize we have choice as to how we're relating to these emotions without any need to get rid of them. Those that are unskillful will self-liberate if we can stay present in this inspired, elevated way, aligned with the Dhamma, or whatever are your deepest values. We do not have to sweep out the ashes of our past mistakes, our past wounds, our past disappointments. If we bring this attitude, this way of aligning and being available through Dhamma eyes, Dhamma heart, the winds of change blow the ashes away. Not the feeling, but that which burns, that causes the suffering, the grasping, the aversion. It gets blown away, these fires. here and now, residing in the heart. This felt sense of the heart, in all its dimensions. The Buddha's teachings become self-evident. They are felt, they are known. They're not treated as concepts, but live truths for each of us here and now. So we'll take a break till 15 minutes after the hour, wherever you are. 15 minutes. I'm sorry, till 15 after the hour. 15 after the hour. And then we'll come back for a talk, and then a time for questions or sharing experience, both about the meditation and then about the naming of things that will be done in the talk. Hope you'll stay for it. See you in 15 after. So, what is this business about creating, you know, resolutions, and that? Why is it that we really get we want to participate in a collective experience, which is done in a very kind of crude way and gets turned into a marketing device and everything else, and yet there's something that makes us go, yeah, something that we can feel something. If we pause, we can feel something calling us in this way, in a really profound way that has nothing to do with the platitudes and all the commercialization. And I would say that going back to when in the the times that one needed to be sheltering in caves or somewhere because of inclement weather, whether hot or cold, that we discovered that our minds, not meaning our brains here, but not excluding the brain, but our minds and our whole nervous system needed to have a kind of pause, that we needed to catch up with ourselves. And that is as true today, or maybe more true today, because of how complex our lives are. That we need to catch up with ourselves. And we sometimes use our birthday to do it, or we use this New Year's, or people go on summer and winter solstice retreats that we have, that we're doing. We're doing these, we need the assistance, the inspiration, the reminder, oh, pause, catch up with ourselves. I certainly have felt that in my retreats, particularly my long retreats, this great luxury of getting to just catch up with myself, aware of such a privilege that is to do, such a privilege. Now, this catching up with ourselves, we can jump to, okay, so what do I need to change? What do I need to, what do I want to do? Da, 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 making our plans. But again, I would suggest that in this pausing, and whatever excuse that gives you a chance to pause, that one of the things to notice first and foremost is, what do you need to let go of? What do you need to let go of? What do you need to surrender? We often try to cram new behavior in while keeping what's already there, and it's too full. Our cup, it just runs over. It doesn't actually empower us. And so one of the talks that I have given in the past starts with this surrendering. What do we need to surrender? So there can be an old wanting that really we don't believe in anymore, even though it'd be great if it had turned out that way, but it didn't turn out that way. And so we surrender it, we let it go. Or it could be this having an attitude of, like, we've got this posture of complaining, and we've clung to it because that was how at one point in our life that we sort of protected ourselves. We had this complaining attitude in one form or another, or this withdrawing attitude, or this not trusting attitude, or whatever it is. Is it time to surrender it? Is it time to surrender it? Likewise, often there's some grudge, some judging, some demand, whether it's we're conscious of it or hidden, that is also calling us. But in this instance, it's not just surrendering, but it involves forgiving. So rather than necessarily emphasizing the three things I want to accomplish in 2024, these are the things that I want to begin my year by surrendering. These are the things I want to let go of by forgiving. It's really a different perspective. So powerful, this surrendering and letting go. And the teaching of this, the third thing that I teach, is you start by surrendering, then you encounter naturally the need to forgive, and then comes naturally this mindfulness of the need to be accountable. That you're not being accountable, like I'm going to hold me accountable, so I'm going to definitely stop this overeating or not sleeping or whatever it is, or, you know, getting mad at my sibling all the time, which, of course, my sibling drags me into this, but we let loose of all of that, and we become accountable. We become accountable to ourselves, but not in this judging, comparing way, but in the mindful discernment, the mindfulness discernment, where the heart is in charge. The heart's in charge. And so we know what's wholesome and unwholesome. We really aren't that confused about that. Really, come on. Mostly we know what's wholesome and unwholesome. And to some degree, we know what is skillful and unskillful. And boy, is life willing to teach us what's skillful and unskillful in a given moment. It's every part of life wants to teach us that. So we learn more and more that rather than judging ourselves, comparing ourselves, and endlessly fixing ourselves or fixing another person, endlessly doing that in our mind, if not actually in our words or our actions, endlessly doing that. Oh, there is a way that the Dhamma teaches us to live, which is the path that it leads to discernment. It leads to discernment. And judging and comparing leads to creating self. It's selfing from a Dharma perspective. But discernment comes from and leads to ever more wisdom and compassion. So it's not got that judging feeling, that stickiness, that contraction of the judging, that contraction, that stickiness of comparing, or that closing off or rejecting of this fixing, reacting, always reacting before we actually stay with our experience that we want to fix, so that we don't even give a chance for wisdom and compassion to arise. So here's a way to deal with catching up with yourself. You invite surrendering. When you encounter something that needs forgiveness, you take forgiveness not as a fixing, but as a practice. You're just practicing because wisdom and compassion is suggesting this forgiving. And you're just practicing it as best you are able. It's just a practice. There's not all of this resulting. It's a movement towards, and I call it being directionally aligned. By the way, as a little thing here in the moment, if this kind of practice interests you, this approach to practice, there's an online community called Dharma Ground. That Dharma Ground, you can go and find more of these kinds of teachings. I'll forget this later, so I'm telling you now in the middle of this so that it gives you a place to go if you're wanting to further explore this. Dharma Ground, whole group of teachers that do this kind of practice method. So we see that that understanding the Buddha's teachings, not from some concept, but here and now, am I contracting? Am I grasping? Am I clinging? Am I being sticky? That whatever it is that we think we wish to change in our life, why not start there? Why not create the space for us to have more what? Choice. To be more what? Available. More aligned. It's a shift in perspective. The whole first part of this practice that we did so much on tonight, you don't have to spend nearly as much time as we did tonight to do that practice. I did that because it's new for most of you and to give you an in-depth feel for it. so that you don't rush through it is just one more thing, but to realize, oh, this is a whole method of practice of the Dhamma in this way before we turn to the Satipatthana and the Eightfold Path and the awakening factors and seeing the hindrances. We put ourselves in a place of empowerment, of choice. So we're prepared. We're prepared. We've got an orientation. We've elevated ourselves. From our thinking, our conceptual mind that's thinking it's going to fix everything. And so once we feel this this sense of, okay, what's to be surrendered here? That's the humility so important in that. And then what's to be forgiven? And the reason that it's so hard for us to forgive oftentimes is that our dignity, our inner dignity has gotten caught up in what we are not forgiving. We're protecting ourselves by not forgiving. And good that we did. Good that we did. But is it necessary now? Or is it in our way? Forgiving ourselves, forgiving others. Again, not this perfect forgiving, but as best I am able. So we align directionally. We want our heart not to be consumed with its anger. We want, insofar as we can be safe while forgiving, we forgive. And when we don't feel safe yet, then we don't forgive. But we know that this is our direction. This is our orientation to our here and now. May I be available to be someone who can surrender what needs to be surrendered and forgive what needs to be forgiven. And may I do so in a way that I am accountable. That's the start of something new. That's one way of catching up with yourself. It's one way. And then we can, from this, our view of what's being called for now, what's being called for, we may realize, oh, it is more kindness to myself. Oh, I am not, when I overeat at night, it's because I am not being kind to myself. I haven't yet developed a practice which allows me to calm down, to a way of being taking care of myself. Maybe I dance for 20 minutes rather than open the refrigerator door. Just play music and I dance. Or maybe I take warm baths. Or maybe I read poetry or read Dhamma or listen to a Dhamma talk. Whatever it may be. But I what's a kind, compassionate way? What would wisdom do here rather than my habits? And again, not complaining about the habits we have. They came about for good reason. So there's no reason to judge those. There's no reason to compare them, but rather to approach our lives so that they naturally release in this way. Another thing that's involved in this new beginnings, we'll call it new beginnings, is that there is something that, again, this would not be a Buddhist teaching alone, but there is an archetypal energies that run through us. We and our nervous systems align with these much larger energies. And on that level, we need to kind of come back to our own and not just be caught in these energies. It can be the energy of being the warrior, or the energy of the defender, or the acquirer, the conqueror, whatever it is, or the energy of the protecting the injured one in ourselves. One of these bigger energies, or this we're protecting ourselves from old age somehow, that we're afraid that if we open to the way we're feeling in terms of our age now, that it's going to overwhelm us. And so we want to have see, is there a new relationship, a never changing relationship with that's available to us? We're not wanting to get rid of what we need. We do not have to approach it that way, but we can ask is this still helpful? Is there, we can put our toe in the water about something. What if I just don't engage in that situation anymore? What if internally I go there, this is practice, 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 as I'm being criticized by this person one more time? It's just practice. May I be the duck in water where the water runs off the back? As an attitude to meeting the moment, not suddenly becoming transformed, but the slowness of practice, the way the Buddha taught it to us. So from a practice perspective, from a Dharma perspective, our taking what's a kind of a common kind of cliched thing about, okay, what are my New Year's resolutions? No, I want to make this a depth practice for me. I want this to be Dharma practice, and that whatever the things that I feel like I need to change, that I'm not being healthy enough, that I'm not getting enough exercise or enough sleep, or my diet's off, or my relationship's off, or I don't have any emotional contact that I really feel seen in. All of those things that are just regular things that we would think or feel, that we take them and we're seeing them from a Dharma eyes, Dharma heart. And so it's a way to bring us to the Dharma, rather than that we're going to magically fix our lives, but rather we're going to use them to remind us that we want to meet life from the Dharma in a way that, in my experience of this approach, many of these things self-release. They self-release because our attitude towards them is not from the way our nervous system, our brain is so fixed into its synapse patterning that we're coming at it from a different angle, and it creates more space around practice. Is this the only way to meet change? Of course not. But it's a way that you've already had experience with and you can have so much support in through Dharma practice. In your local sitting group, with a friend, online listening, online participating, and so forth. So Dharma-centric approach to this change. And as I mentioned in the meditation, if not now, when? If not now, when? How many more years do you want to spend before you treat yourself with more kindness, more wisdom? How many more years do pass before you stop letting your reactive ego that was conditioned, so it's not to blame at all, but was conditioned in order to survive, to even thrive, to still let that go on and make choices for you rather than your values making the choice? So Dharma-centric, values-centric in this approach. And then we come to this human experience that we have good intentions, but we lose it. We forget. We get discouraged. We get overwhelmed by all these other demands on our lives because we're making it a to-do list kind of thing, and we don't do the to-do list for all of these reasons. But if we're treating it as a practice, that these are value-based ways I'm wanting to live, and I'm wanting to treat it as I treat any part of Dharma practice, then this teaching of that are there in the paramis, the kind of attainments that one can develop over time, that's character based in a way, new habits, if you want to think of it another way. And we come to this idea that when we get knocked off, we start over. That Sharon Salzberg does such a great job of teaching. Wow, I remember that so well from 40 years ago. First time I heard her do it, it's that we start over. So we get knocked down, we get back up. So we've forgotten for a month that we were doing this, where we're treating our bad behavior, our bad meaning, unskillful, that's a poor choice of words, our unskillful behavior, that we're approaching it not from fixing it, but from practice. We're wanting to bring compassion and wisdom to this. Okay, I can feel this compulsion. Oh, this is starting to happen. I haven't even thought about it starting to happen. Rather going into reaction, judging about it, we're going, oh, this is one of the ways I'm creating suffering. And so we start over. Even though we've not thought about it for a month or 6 weeks, we simply start over. And I would add to that, Sharon's wonderful teaching about this, because in much of, as she and many other teachers have said, much of meditation practice is just starting over. You're being with the breath, you lose it, you just start over. You're just trying to be mindfully present and you'd get totally lost. You're not present at all. You just start over. The thing that I've observed in all of these years of teaching, all of these decades of teaching, is so often people have not developed the capacity to start where they are. You might go, but of course I'm starting where else would I be starting? That's a very good question. But we have this idea of how we're supposed to be when we start practicing, or how we're supposed to be in the middle of a practice. In any given moment, you just start where you are. If the mind's sleepy, the sleepy mind is doing practice. And therefore, there's not all of that judging, comparing, fix it. It's just sleepiness. Restless mind is doing practice. Wanting mind. So now you're in your daily life, but you're doing your practice walking down the street. You're doing your practice when you're sitting in your car, when you're fixing breakfast. So your mind's going in this unskillful way or that unskillful way. Ah, recognition, realizing that suffering, and recognizing that suffering, and realizing, oh, I have a choice, at least in this moment. I'm starting where I am. This mind is restless right now. It's wanting something, and I'm acting out the wanting. What degree of choice do I have around this wanting? May I be available in this moment? Am I available to myself in this moment that I have choice? So we remember and we realize, we remember, we recognize what's suffering and not suffering, and we realize that sometimes we have choice to some degree by starting where we are. If we go to the concept of how I should be, but we're not there. We're not there in that should be. We're not. Oh, this is how I want to be, but we're not there. May I be available to have choice here and now, just now. Then our resolutions, however you want to make them, I'm not saying you have to make them any other way than your habit of making them, but our resolutions are held by, filtered through our Dhamma values in this way. We are available to life through the Dhamma. Same old thing we do. We don't have to be any better, but we shift the view, we shift the attitude in terms of the formal teachings. That would be wise view and wise intention of the Eightfold Path. Wise view is samadhi, is in this moment, in the view of like how we're viewing. What is our aspiration? So imagine that in terms of that it's wise view, is wise aspiration, that this is how I aspire to have this aspect of my life be otherwise, that's got less suffering in it for myself or another, or myself and another. So this is my aspiration, wise aspiration, the first of the Eightfold Path, generally called wise view. And then the second of the Eightfold Path is wise intention. In this very moment. And so the intention, the understanding that in this moment, seeing what my choices are and intending to meet this moment with wisdom and compassion, even if I have no choice other than to recognize the appropriateness of doing something different as I'm doing something, But recognizing it from wisdom and compassion, not from judging mind, not from this comparing mind, not from the shoulds. If the shoulds were going to work, they would have worked already for us, huh? How many times have we had should moments in our lives? Don't work very well. Why? Because it's separating us. It's also contracting into that self that's separating us from the truth of our experience, and so often separating us from our hearts. So in this way, we start where we are, here and now. May I be available to here and now so that I can start here. And if I forget, may I be able to start over to be available. And available in what way? Through wisdom and compassion, through this discernment of wisdom and compassion, rather than the shoulds, rather than this compulsion to fix that so separates us from ourselves. To me, this is the Buddha's offering. You know, he had tried to be a good student, and he studied with these two teachers of his, whom he learned a lot from, and each asked him to stay and teach with them, because he so mastered what they knew, and he said to each of them, thank you, but this is not what I seek. And then he became an ascetic. So he was doing the shoulds. He should study with others. He should be an ascetic. So he's going to deny life. And that's why he's going to conquer life. And after a number of years of doing this, he realized, no, that should doesn't work. If it was going to work, it would have worked by now. And he chose the middle path, even though his friends scorned him for it. And he went off by himself, committed to this middle path. He started eating again, and he sat down with resolution that, to me, is this discernment, with a resolution. It wasn't should. This is what I'm about. May I be available to do this? May I stay here till I stay available till I can do it? And that's what happened on his night of enlightenment. One thing after another came as insight of liberating insight until it was done. It was finished. What needed to be done had been done. House builder, you will build no more. Your center pole has been broken. In our small way, we can have moments of this in our lives as Dhamma practice. That's the invitation. So with that invitation, then if there are questions that or comments about the practice, the meditation practice we did, or about the talk that's been offered in the talk, I welcome you to raise your hand to do it. I do want to say one other thing first. Actually, I started before I ever started teaching. I'd been practicing for a long time before this, but some 40 years ago, whatever now, I could have to stop and count. I had people started coming to me around changes in their life before I was using the Dharma frame at all. And they did that because I had a little bit of a public role, and people of my generation, a number of them had projections on me about how I was living. And so when I walked away from the daily marketplace life in a very public way, they came to me saying, well, I want to do this, or I want to make this change, or I want whatever. I was unprepared for that. That was just a surprise to me. And but I responded because I wanted to give back. I felt very fortunate, very, very fortunate that I could make a big change in my life in this way, and had the guts to do it. And so I gave back. And then that became a whole a way of service that I have served in a serving way for all of these decades, with people making changes and transitions in their life, people wanting to restructure their life, people wanting to make decisions in a wise way, compassionate way. And I ended up training in other people to do this. So there's a whole group of what are called strategists that you can find in Life Balance Institute website, the Life Balance Institute website. I'm not trying to get you to go to that website, but I am saying to you as proof of concept here, I have gone through change with so many people, not just on retreats, certainly done lots of that, done lots of mentoring and all. I taught a weekly class for 17 years where I stayed at the end of each Sunday night as long as someone was there that wanted to talk to me about some change in their life. But I've also spent hours and hours over periods of weeks, months, years with various individuals dealing with them, their change and transitions. So I offer that as, again, proof of concept. There would be reason to think, oh, well, he may have had enough experience that some of what he's saying's got a little common sense to it, a little practicality. It's not some theoretical thing, because I am not big on the theoretical. I am big on the practical. If it doesn't work on the street of life, I don't want to offer it to someone, because we're lay people. We live on the street of life. And that's where we're going to choose non-suffering over suffering, from my perspective. So with that, now, any questions or comments that you have, and you would do so by using that whatever it's called, the reactions button, and raise your hand.
PJ?
Hi, Philip. Thanks so much for the talk and the meditation. I think I have a simple question, or I'm not really sure. I'm looking for some clarity on why does surrender lead to forgiveness? Can you say a little bit more about
how you're... I like you asking that.
Connected.
Thank you for asking. You think that you're going to surrender, you know, I'm going to surrender and I'm going to let it go, but you don't. So why does that happen? It's because so often, not always, but so often, there is something that we have not forgiven ourselves for, or we've not forgiven another person. And it's in the way, so we can't let it go. We may not recognize that, but it's in the way. Right here, right now, it's in the way. And I've listened to so many people. Again, this is a report from the field. It's not some concept. So you realize, well, okay, I didn't defend myself there. I can't surrender. I can't surrender because I won't forgive myself. I'm still holding on to it. I'm holding on to this anger about it, or this rejecting of me, this part of me, because that part of me didn't protect me better, or whatever it may be. Or, oh, I did this thing, you know, I want to surrender all this guilt about this relationship, because it was, I just need to let this relationship go, period. So why can't you? Because you have not been able to let go of this, to let go of this feeling that you were unskillful, that your regret is actually in the form of punishing yourself, holding on. You don't feel worthy, or you may have all sorts of different stories about it, but you haven't let go of it. You haven't let go of it. So you can't surrender it, because you won't, without forgiving, the heart's still closed in some way. And the mind's got a fixity, but it's the heart, that the heart's still closed. So when the heart opens, that's where the possibility of the mind letting go, because it's really stuck in those synapses, you know, as a view. It's a view. It's a very fixed view. And that's why they need to come together. But the second part of that question could well be, but then why accountability? Because we can try spiritual bypass here. And this is not about spiritual bypass. If when you're forgiving yourself or another, you're taking responsibility as you forgive. But the responsibility is towards now and the future. You can't undo what has been done. If there's some kind of thing that you can do to help with the past, you do. But you can't change the past. You redeem the past by how you behave now and in the future. It's a law. Any comment about that?
Sort of. As I'm listening to you kind of elaborate, I'm hearing forgiveness as bringing compassion to the situation. And so it's not necessarily, maybe it's not necessarily so narrowly defined in my mind as I forgive you or I forgive myself, but it's wrapping it in compassion.
Wisdom and compassion both. That's discernment. Wise, compassionate discernment. Wisdom and compassion. Wisdom recognizes, and compassion is the impulse to respond. And compassion is a response. It's not a reaction, from my point of view. We don't have time for that. But so, yes, it's wisdom and compassion. And this, I'm really serious about this. I'm hoping all of you can feel how serious I am, because I do this on these first of the years. I try to be there every year for Spirit Rock first of the year for some number of years now, because, we haven't learned to do this very well, this brain about change in our life. So I spend all this time doing it, so I want to share what I can, but in a real way of empowering you. There's not anything you're supposed to believe here. There's things that, go practice this and see if it's true for me.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll sit with that.
George?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank you, because you your book literally saved my life many years ago, brought me back from the brink of suicide. So thank you very much. It was after I lost my spouse to cancer. And through the help of your book and the practice, I managed to overcome that. And I have a family now. Beautiful family, but my fear remains losing my family, and it's one of the greatest obstacles that I have in my practice, I think. And of course, beginning of the year, every time, you think back and you think forward, like you mentioned, and I was wondering how you would approach this fear that is, for me, palpable and very real. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think stops me from living.
I really understand. My heart's really responding right this moment to that. And I'd like to begin by when your wife died, just recognizing the pain of that, and that's very, very difficult.
And, it was the worst pain I've ever felt.
Yeah. I've worked with many people who've gone through this, and also with their children. And, some really dramatic situations of it. And what I say to over and over again is that that loss is a real loss. And the loss isn't the problem. It's our demand that it be otherwise. And we forget to celebrate that to have known someone that we love that much is a celebration. And what happens is that our system, we don't trust our system, that if we just open to that love that much, we feel like we're going to be overwhelmed. But while we get, we believe we can't bear it. And so suicide thoughts come, ideation comes. But in fact, that's just a view, but we don't realize it's just a view. How wonderful that our hearts have opened that much to a person. So our view is all one-sided, and and it takes years for you to work your way out. And working our way out is not the shock of it, and that it takes time is not the problem, but there's this kind of demand, this is not acceptable. It's not acceptable to me. I can't bear it. But in fact, love itself, it invites bearing. I will love, and if loss comes with it, then I will bear the loss because I believe in love. You see this switch in attitude? And then, and I don't say this lightly. This is not some little sweet kind of thing. I'm talking about the nitty gritty of it. My life is not a life that was, my life wasn't such that, this all comes from my own life, I'll leave it at that. And then like your fear now about losing your family, of course that would be a concern for every person. And then you've had this history of losing once. So again, the same courage. And this is the courage of the Buddha. I choose love, and I acknowledge that there's all sorts of possible loss, and I choose love. I give witness to love in the face of the dukkha of life. I will not let the dukkha of life control me. I will not let the dukkha of life defeat me. This is the courage of the heart, this kuira, you know, it's not a mamby-pamby kind of thing. It's like down to your toes. It's in the deep of your belly. It's like your heart could break open. And with humility, as best I am able, I choose love. And for that fear, that's a natural concern, you say, may I have a, I don't know if you can hear the coyotes. They just started howling. So they're participating in this.
Indeed.
Yeah, and so this is, but that's the feeling of that level of, that's what it feels like in the heart, just like those coyotes howling right now. That you give yourself. The humility allows us to do it because we think we're supposed to hold it like all this big, strong person. No, it's with this humility. May I bear this gift of love, even in its way of cost, with care. Yeah. So that love will beareth all things, you know, as it's been said before. And so therefore, the Buddhist thing of non-clinging, you know, and when all love ends up in a loss, but what the world needs is more love. It gets the loss anyway, you see. And so it's a shift in perspective here, and it starts with this humility in the way we approach it. At least that's what I have discovered.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I'm glad you're still here with us.
Me too.
Steven?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Compared to the last one, it seems very minor, but about 4 years ago, I was fired as a substitute teacher, being in the same district for 2 decades. And since I didn't have tenure, I didn't even have a right to say anything. And it really devastated me, and it kind of ruined a year of my life because I had no protection. And that's how it is as a sub. You have no protection and you don't even have a right to say anything. So, you know, now I've been subbing again, and this is after, and I started subbing after a 35 and over a 35 year job, you know, as a regular teacher. And I'm looking now of like being a test examiner, but the person that I got fired from is working in one of those schools. And it makes me feel like avoiding that particular principal and not doing the job because I don't trust how they think. And they might look at me as a threat to kids, which I'm not at all. And I have no history of that. But I didn't even have a right to even say what I did wrong, which I really didn't do anything wrong. I just followed my lesson plan. I just was a little theatrical. And one kid, you know, didn't like me because I had her as a regular student for a year. And they just lied and created a monster in my head. And I'm not sure how to go on with that. And I'm aware that really, you're supposed to really let go of the past. But I'm not sure how to let go of the past when you're around someone that could still be very threatening to you.
So letting go of the past doesn't mean that we don't learn from the past. So, you know, that thing that's about you walk down the street and you fall in the hole, and then you walk down the street again, you fall in the same hole, and then you gradually realize, you know, that, oh, I can step around the hole and all of this, and there's a gradual learning about this. So, and eventually just don't go down that road because there's a hole in it. And this may be your situation. There's a hole in this road. So why would you go down it? And I'm not in a position to know, but your caution sounds like an appropriate caution. So, beware of both sides. If you ask yourself, is there a safe way if you're going to be in fear the whole time going down this road, it doesn't sound like a road you would necessarily choose to go down. And so if there's some way to address the problem on the front end about dealing with that principle, or is that because that principle, if that principle can undermine you at any moment, then why are you putting yourself in this situation? So letting go doesn't mean that you don't learn from the past. And if this person is not a safe person to be vulnerable to, then and you're gonna live in anxiety the whole time, is that really the way you want to live? And is there a way to address it? Is there someone you can talk with and ask them and say, hey, this is the situation. Is there a skillful way for me to handle this? And if they say no, then don't do it. You know?
There's no skillful way to handle this in the public school system. If you go ahead and you're vulnerable, it's looked at as against you. There's no safe space there.
And you may have answered your own question.
So it sounds to me that I should just avoid the whole.
Yes, because you want to be kind to yourself. You want to have compassion towards yourself and use your wisdom in a way that is for compassion. And your experience is saying this is not safe. So then what is it that's leading you to do this, you see?
And I think it's a desire for acceptance. Yeah. And, you know, self-acceptance. And I don't know if that's the right place to go for acceptance when it's a definite hole.
I hear wisdom right now coming out of your mouth.
That's okay, good. Yeah. So I don't think I should put myself in that situation.
I bow to your wisdom.
Okay. Thank you. I sat with you almost 40 years ago.
My goodness. At Spirit Rock, or where was this?
Barry, Massachusetts.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
1985.
Nice to see you again.
Thank you so much. We had a couple of conversations, if I remember, at least one, but probably two, at least one. Thank you.
My pleasure. I'll take one more if there's one more.
Josette, are you trying to raise your hand?
If somebody's got their hand up.
Okay, we can go with Cheryl.
No, it's okay. Okay, can you hear me? Well, English is not my mother tongue, okay? So excuse my accent. And I am speaking to you from France, and I live actually just under the hill where Christianity was brought to the West many years ago, okay, before Christ, actually. Mm-hmm. And I followed towards the end of your talk, and I have been sitting with Jack since 1979 when I was living in Vancouver. Okay, so you see a connection. I was working for an airline, and my son is still there, but I came back to my birth city. So, and I'm very happy I can follow online, although for me it's 4 a.m. and 6 a.m, so I'll try to go back to sleep a little bit, so it's the middle of the night. But I understood, because I have realized something, and I practice it every day now. I live in the center of the city, in the historical part, so there's lots of transportation, lots of people, you know, looking for refuge, and some dies in the Mediterranean, horrible things, and all these wars, you know, in Europe and all that. So I have lots of opportunities to practice. And I have realized not very long ago, after all these many years of practice, that actually when I started to understand that I am part of humanity, and that the other person, I could be that other person. And actually, in my behavior, what I can show or what I express is what humanity, in a way, taken as a whole, can do. And of course, I can only come from my own conditioning and all these kind of things, you know. And with that practice, that allows me to become aware of that, and when I go, I take the subway and I see people angry or they are going to fight. Before, I might be afraid that they would, because there's a lot of incivilities in the street there and young people. And historically, I can understand it, you know, because my country, I was a child, but I still remember scenes during the war of Algeria and all that, where people. One of my brother was actually had volunteered with the firemen, and every morning almost they were taking out of the river. You know, there's two rivers in the city in mm-hmm. Lyon. Mm-hmm. To people like Algerian people, there was a war between them. Now I'm reading all this, and you know they had been drowned. You know, and they would pull them out and all that, this kind of thing. So these are the memories I have. And I thought, you know, maybe I should write this, because I coming back to my home city, I can see how the situation has evolved, where now there's lots of problems because of that. But anyway, so just to tell you, and I actually wrote a little text. It's a very short text. And where I spoke both actually of Christianity, because of course I learned about, you know, how the first Christians were martyrized here in Lyon itself. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you can see it all around and all this. So that's history, but there's also churches all around. And actually, I go and practice my meditation, and sometimes I go with friends, and we can go in church and in churches, because it's a safe place. Nobody, although sometimes there are some jihadists coming, and you know, these kind of things have happened lately. But this is a place I can go. I am pretty safe, and they say they actually do time, and in that little hill. In that hill, which is just above, I can see it from where I'm speaking to you. I can see that's where all the tourists go when they come mm-hmm. to this city. Mm-hmm. It's very historical, okay? And you can go there. You can do what they call adoration all day long. I think it goes from 10 in the morning until 28 p.m. when they close the basilica, and except when they make a mass, which is 2-3 times a day or something like that. And you can go there, and I do my meditation when I go there, not to be alone, get out of my little studio, and that there are people around. And, you know, so, you know, it's a place I can go, and there are several churches I can go around in the city, but it's the practice of in the street, or when I see two young men, sometimes they can be quite violent with one another. And before, I would not dare speak to them, you know, by fear they would hurt me and something. But now, no, I don't really interfere. And this argument that you mentioned, I can tell you it has changed my life since I've understood that. So I'm very happy you actually expressed it, because, and you know, we are on different parts of the Atlantic Ocean. Actually, my husband is close to the Pacific Ocean. My son too, they're in Vancouver, BC. And Jack had come up there. My first retreat was in 1979 with Jack and Joseph, I remember that, and around Vancouver. And so what I wanted to say is, like, and I do that now. I mean, I'm cautious. I practice myself. But when I see two men, you know, they react very quickly, and they're ready to fight. And very kindly, I said, well, you do what you have to do, but please don't hurt one another, you know. Just speak to one another and all that. And actually, they're surprised that, anyway, it works, you know. But of course, I'm very cautious and all that. Or if a mother gets upset in the subway because she has a baby in her arm, and you know the other child, you know, start to scream or make problem and all that, to help the mother, I would speak to the child to draw his attention somewhere else. And sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't work, but most of the time it works, actually. But I'm cautious not to take over the mother. And that comes, I think, since it's not an intellectual understanding I came to after all these many years of practice, but it's something visceral that I understood I'm part of humanity. I have the choice to do this or to do that. And I have the choice to take some risks sometimes too, because I have to protect myself, but not to disturb, also to respect the other person. But by, so it's in a sense, if, like, you know, I've been mistreated actually by a family member, but I still will not take vengeance, you know. So I wait. It has had serious consequences, but I wrote this text, which is entitled Between Divine and entre divin et infernal, between divine and infernal, like, you know, what's unbearable, because it was a text for some Protestant people, you know, that had asks our deep thinking and all that. And it was like delivering a baby for me to write this text. I spent 2 mornings, because I was looking after my mother, so I had only 2 mornings, 5 hours, but I went in such a concentration. It's a very short text. So since I was raised here, so I was exposed to Christianity and all that teaching and all that, and actually I feel kind of privileged, you know, because I'm under this basilica before it was the Roman people, you know, that had conquered the people, you know, this kind of historical. So it's very historical, and I am in there. And then the second part, though, I said, and, but these people did not know that I had also I was lucky to be in contact with some thoughts coming from the East and all that. And what's very special, and that's for Jack, I say it because, you know, it's I know him, and now I can follow him a little bit once a month online, but in the middle of the night, is when I came back to my home city in Lyon, and I discovered there was one student of Ajahn Chah, French, living close to Lyon, and he had come, and I took up on his group. He's passed away now, but he went, and his master was Ajahn Chah. He went to Thailand, and he brought back the teaching, and he did that around around Lyon. He lives not very far. Now he passed out, but I went to retreats there. And when I came back from, you know, Canada, where I was living, I met my husband and all that. And I found that, I thought, this is wonderful. And I saw Jack even on the French TV, you know, in English. There's a program in the morning. So the gift, if I am speaking to you now, so Jack is behind that, but I want you that what you said today is the first time I see you, and you know, I follow that. And I dare speaking, although my English, I don't speak English every day now. I speak French and all that. But what you said, comes at a right moment for me, because I have realized not very long ago, a few months ago, that the only way to go is that, you know, going towards the divine rather than the infernal, not to nourish what hurts and all that. And even if it hurts me, because it's not me, I am part of humanity, and I can see how my feelings change and all that. But I also have become very aware, why do we have war in Ukraine, war in Gaza, because I'm closer than you are, okay, where I live. It all comes from the fact that, instead of going towards the divine, or, you know, what you said, like forgiveness and all that, we want to protect this little me. But this little me is so big when we all include one another. And you are, I could be you, I'm not you, but I could be you, but I'm part. That's how I see it now. And it has really changed my life. So anyway, I followed you towards the end because, you know, I'm a bit drowsy.
I celebrate that in you. I really celebrate that you've come to that understanding, and I can feel how genuine it is. I mentioned that word humility. If you are going to go up to people the way you're doing, I really stress the importance of keeping that humility so that you don't take an identity. That the only way you have a chance of being safe is that they feel your humility, and they don't feel like you're being, thinking you're better than them or something. Mm-hmm. So that humility is very important. And please be careful with yourself. You said you were being
caught. I am, because it's quite dangerous. So I don't go out at night, you know. I stay very my little studio, and I watch Spirit Truck online, not just Spirit Truck. We have some that we do on Zoom in French, you know. But anyway, thank you very much. That's all I can say. And say thanks to Jack, because I have written to him. I don't know if he remembers me. I was at the beginning. I remember when I went to Barre, Massachusetts, and it was in Yucca Valley that we would go.
I will twice do a year. That. I have to.
So he might remember me. He would
I will
remember
do,
that.
I will but do anyway. That.
Yeah, but anyway, thank you very much. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. And Susie G, if you're still here, I guess maybe you're gone. Let's all just pause for a moment here, and just come back to ourselves. And ask yourself, do I have some felt sense of being available? Do I get it? Do I get this being available and aligned? Do I get it? Do I get it? Do I want to understand it more? Just being available. So grateful for the Dhamma. So grateful that the Dhamma is still available in our time, and so grateful that we have this interest to pursue it, to understand it in relation to bringing about the end of suffering in our own lives. Thank you for coming. Maybe our paths will cross again in the Dhamma.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.